From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Like Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, a local economist explains how Governor Scott Walker's policies may have cost the state 80,000 jobs.
Then, when it comes to healing trauma in the community, one expert says leaders need to appeal to our society's better angels.
When leaders appeal to our worst demons, it shows how right below the surface they are, and they rise up. I think what's at stake in this country, literally, is the soul of the nation and the integrity of faith.
Later, our Beats Me segment explores the intersection of race and education.
Plus, what makes UW-Milwaukee especially friendly to its LGBTQ+ population.
I would say that the high score comes from student engagement and really reflecting the needs of our campus population. So students have a voice and have an opportunity to make a difference and create change.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. When Governor Scott Walker mounted his first gubernatorial campaign, he made a bold claim that during his first term as governor, he would create 250,000 jobs for Wisconsinites. He is just now nearing that figure after nearly two terms on the job.
In reality, most economists believe that governors have a limited impact on how many jobs are created in a given state. That being said, local economist Bruce Thompson believes that while small, Walker's policies may actually have resulted in a loss of 80,000 jobs in Wisconsin.
Thompson wrote about this in his regular column for Urban Milwaukee, and he joins me now in studio. Bruce, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
Just to kind of start here, why do we so often use, you know, job creation as this kind of measure of our economy?
Well, it's certainly not the only thing. It has one advantage, is that the federal government collects figures every month for every state and most big cities. And so we have lots of data. And so it's one indicator of how well we're doing. Other ones, like the gross national product or gross domestic product, maybe take in more, but they're only calculated once a year. And I think they have more error in them. If you just look at them, they jump around more. So a job one is a good one to do, but again, it's not the whole thing.
Yeah. One of the things you talk about in your analysis is the kind of impact that politicians ultimately have on job creation. It's obviously something they tout all the time, but what is that impact?
It's something that economists are very skeptical about, that governors and presidents take a lot of credit when things are good, and when things are bad, their constituents blame them and they maybe, run out of office. But most economists think that most of the effect, how Wisconsin does has much more to do with the history of Wisconsin, the kinds of industries we have, the kind of skills we have, how many of our population have college degrees. All of those things probably have more to do with it.
So let's look at some of the rhetoric that we've heard from Walker himself and his administration when it comes to job. What is he taking credit for, and what has really happened?
Well, of course, he famously promised 250,000 jobs in his first term, which was, I guess you could call it a mistake, or it worked and helped him get elected, so it may have been a smart thing to do. The growth was about half of that, and if you look at the numbers right now, we're just about at that point in two terms rather than one term. I think the 250,000 was totally unrealistic. And again, falling short had much more to do with the national creation. This was a very slow recovery that happened compared to last few recoveries. And it's also, by the same terms, it's a long one. It's gone for about 10 years now, pretty much a steady one. So now you see Trump taking credit for it. But it really looks very much like just an extension of the Obama recovery.
As Obama himself research
Yeah, he
said.
Pointed that yeah. out. And I think he tried to be more modest. I think you can give him credit early on for acting to stop the recession, you know, to pump money into the economy and get people to working and keep the banks from going bankrupt. But since then, it's been much more the banks that have made a difference or just the economy in general that's been growing.
So you had a number of graphs in your analysis.
Yeah.
One,
which don't work very well on the radio, I should add.
not quite as well as it does on the web. But one of them pointed out, you know, the expected growth of jobs in Wisconsin and what actually happened. So
right.
How were those numbers compiled?
Okay, those are all from the federal figures.
Okay.
And the problem you have in any public policy debate is you say, well, we know what the numbers were, but what would they have been if something different had happened? And that's sometimes called the counterfactual. And you always see this phrase. Unfortunately, we can't really decide what the counterfactual is. And so I decided to try to construct a counterfactual. And basically, these state numbers have been collected since January of 1990. So to get the counterfactual, I took six states in addition to Wisconsin, the four that border on Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan, Illinois, and Iowa, and then two others that sort of look like Wisconsin, Ohio, and Indiana. And I took the numbers for all of those states between 1990 and 2011 when Walker came in and developed what's called a regression equation. And that's basically, it's kind of everything in the kitchen sink. You have these numbers from the six other states, you throw them in, and it cranks it through, and it builds a model that has the least possible error in it that comes as close as possible to the actual numbers. And so I built that model for the period before 2011 when he actually entered. And then I applied that to the almost 8 years after that. And again, it was all predicting Wisconsin's jobs based on the jobs in those six other states. The idea is that all of these states are pretty much reacting to the same things. They go up when there's a lot of demand for agricultural goods or manufactured things. They all suffer from the global, you know, movement of production overseas. And the graph before 2011 came out very close. You almost can't see the two lines. They fit on each other so well. So the model seemed to work very well for the period before Walker came in. Then I applied it to the Walker term. And what I found is the model over-predicted how many jobs we would have. It overestimated what the actual was by about 70 or 80,000 jobs by this time. And so one possible conclusion is that the things that Walker did cost Wisconsin 80,000 jobs, which is a number I feel comfortable with. Some people could say, well, you didn't account for something else. But it's hard to see anything big that changed. If, say, Wisconsin were like North Dakota and had fracking or something, then all bets are off. You can't say, well, they did much better than South Dakota, and therefore it doesn't mean anything about their policies.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a significant number, 70 to 80,000
yeah.
jobs.
It's nowhere equal to what he promised, but and we still, you know, we've still had job growth, but so has almost everywhere else in the United States.
Yeah, since the recession.
Right, yes.
So when you really analyze what Walker has done, what are the things that pop out to you as possible issues from his administration?
Yeah, there were much more speculating, but he has pretty much adopted the theory of supply-based economics. And if you look at it in more detail, it's cutting the regulation and taxes. And so he's emphasized those things. So, and those have a counter effect, because if you cut, you know, taxes, then you have more trouble supporting the schools or universities, or and those are things that people would like. They resist paying for them, but they have a good deal to do with the quality of life.
Well, if anyone has seen those banners that say, you know, Scott holes, then
yeah, I'm of the opinion that increasingly, if you look at where the area prospers, you know, it used to be this is the place where the transportation comes together, you know, where the harbors are, where the raw materials are. It's much more these are the places that people want to live. You know, people move to, say, California, and then they start companies, but they move there because they like California. And I've talked to some companies that consult with employers, and they're saying the employers want to identify places to set up, say, branches where the young engineers want to live that look like the Silicon Valley, but they're cheaper. And so they're neighborhoods in Milwaukee that sort of appeal to that group.
Yeah.
And so the employers, in many cases, will follow the employees rather than vice versa.
Well, where people want to live.
Yeah.
One of the things you pointed to, which I didn't actually know about, was the state's interesting laws regarding road safety for bicycles.
Yeah, that was a very strange thing, that there's a national campaign to require whenever the state builds a road that it be accessible for bicycles and pedestrians as well as automobiles. And Wisconsin passed that law, and it's the only state that's then gone back and removed the law. And there's a message there, you know, if bicycling is part of an attractive environment for you, why is the state doing this?
Well, and the administration, Walker, denied federal funds for a couple different big things, the obvious being healthcare, but also a train going
right
from Milwaukee to Madison.
Right. You can criticize those on two levels. One is that in order to pay for healthcare for people, the state is paying more, and therefore there are fewer funds for other things. The other is the quality of life question. You know, people would like alternatives to having to drive everywhere. You know, a couple of years ago, we visited Switzerland, and you can almost get a train to anywhere. And if they're not trains, they're buses that coordinate with the trains. And we even found, you know, school kids would be riding the trains. You know, a whole class would get off because they rode to the next town to go to school.
Is there any acknowledgement from Walker, from his administration, that there is a desire for these infrastructure projects among Wisconsinites and among probably employers?
You know, he's promised to increase the educational budget, which, you know, he had cut right after he came in, which I think is, in a way, an acknowledgement that people have a higher priority than that. Marquette Law School just released their last poll. There was the question about what is the higher priority, lower taxes or more education, and it was clear on the education that people were willing to spend more money to increase the educational budget. And I think he's reacting to that, but his constituency is not in places like Milwaukee on the whole, you know, so he may not take that as a most important thing.
Yeah. So when we look at what's happened with the Walker administration, what's happened with job growth, and the kinds of decisions that could have and often do lead to these kinds of issues, how is what Walker's administration done, how is that going to impact us into the future, impact Wisconsin moving forward? Can we know?
I think some of that will impact us for a long time. People often compare Wisconsin to Minnesota, which is higher job growth. It's nowhere near where, say, California or some of the other states in the Sun Belt are. But again, it's hard to say what's the cause of that. But one of the differences is the higher percentage of people with college degrees in Minnesota rather than Wisconsin. So cutting back on education has a long-term effect by changing our population that way, I think. So I think there is a long-term, but some of it's short-term. You know, certainly Wisconsin had the reputation of being a very environmentally oriented state and a high service level state. Part of that is just changing some of those policies back.
All right. Well, Bruce, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and speaking with me today.
Well, thank you very much.
Bruce Thompson is a professor emeritus at the Rader School of Business at the Milwaukee School of Engineering. Thompson also writes a regular column for Urban Milwaukee called Data Wonk.
One of the national speakers at this week's conference on trauma in Milwaukee makes a special appeal to the faith community. That comes your way next on Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. A wide spectrum of people from across the Milwaukee community will meet later this week to address the profound effect trauma is having on many of the people who live here and on the community at large. The Healing Trauma Healthy Communities Conference is being convened by a coalition called SWIM, Scaling Wellness in Milwaukee, and is being sponsored by the social service organization St. A.
Over 3 days, people will discuss the intricacies of understanding trauma and the work of trauma-informed care. But they'll also discuss bigger picture issues. Reverend Jim Wallace, in particular, will address how racism and segregation are part of the equation. Wallace is founder and president of Sojourners, a national organization that connects communities of faith with social justice issues. We reached him by phone from Washington, D.C. Thank you for taking a few minutes to talk.
Good to be with you.
Where do you see your work, especially your faith-based work, intersecting with the aim of this conference on trauma?
Well, let me start with a sports story, given this would be in the Milwaukee Bucks facility. I was a Little League baseball coach for 22 seasons, 11 years, a long time with my two boys. And every black player that I ever coached, whether they were a low-income family in Washington, D.C., or whether they were one of the city's elites, lawyers and political leaders, every black family had the talk with their child, their player, about how to behave in the presence of a police officer, where to hold your hands out of your eyes, your body language, to protect yourself in the presence of a police officer. None of my white players ever had that talk, and almost none of my white parents knew that talk was even happening. That's a profoundly different experience, not even based on income or geography, but in fact on the color of your skin. Black parents these days are often afraid to send their kids out to school. These are tremendous cultural differences defined by our racial geography. When moms talk to other moms about the future for their kids, their hopes, their dreams, their fears, it's a powerful bonding time. But not enough of that crosses racial lines. And dads, too. That's what we have to do. Understand what my kids' teammates and classmates who are people of color experience and feel and fear every day. Until we come to a deeper understanding of each other and listen to each other, we won't get through this difficult period.
Right. What would you say the cost to the community at large is? I mean, we think of these sometimes on a case-by-case basis, but you would contend that this has a real impact on all of us.
Well, in fact, here's a little stat. 72% of white Christians believe these incidents are that, incidents, isolated incidents. 82% of black Christians say they are systemic and part of a pattern of their own lives. So what does it mean when white Christians have so little understanding of what black Christians are going through, even if they're both Christians? So how do we understand these issues are systemic? They are structural, they are cultural, they are historic, and people have created these structures that we can change. The hope is we can change these things. But systemic change is needed, and accountability for law enforcement, accountability for all of us is important here. Because when law enforcement is so differently experienced, policing and the whole structure of law enforcement, the film that you all know about Milwaukee 53206, the incarcerated district. How does that affect everything else? It affects education, economics. It affects how we relate to each other and all of us being safe. So how do we come together and understand that our future is listening to each other, as this event is going to try and do? Let's listen to each other, understand each other's cultures and different experiences, especially for our kids. When we do that, I think that's a real way of going forward.
You mentioned that a terrific film, 53206, but more frequently, the media that we're exposed to does cover this on an incident-by-incident basis. Where do you think we in the media get the story wrong, and how can we start telling the story differently?
Well, I think to understand what I'm trying to say to media all the time is that these issues are indeed systemic. They're cultural. They're based on racial geography. Our racial geography in this country separates us almost entirely. Here's a 75% of white people in America don't have any person or family of color in their social circle, their immediate. So that's today. It's our racial geography. Now, geography isn't by accident. It's by policy. It's by real estate, banking policies, housing policies. And so we are separated from each other. My experience is you begin to understand when you are proximate to each other, when you have conversation, when you know each other. It's hard to dismiss or write off people that you know or put them in the stereotypes. When we know each other and begin to listen to each other's stories and trust each other's stories, that's the beginning of the changes we have to make in our system.
You're going to be, as you say, you're going to be speaking at the Milwaukee Bucks new arena in front of an audience of people who are really hungry to have this conversation. Is there one single or maybe a couple of really concrete steps you would hope that people can take to get this change started when they walk out of the Fiserv Forum?
You know, I've heard there's a real interest in this, and that is by itself to me very encouraging, because I think a lot of people are hungry for this. We've been polarized. We're a polarized nation because political leaders have appealed to our fears, our resentments, even our hatreds. Abraham Lincoln said that leaders should appeal to our better angels. But when leaders appeal to our worst demons instead, it shows how right below the surface they are, and they rise up. I think what's at stake in this country, literally, is the soul of the nation and the integrity of faith. And I think if we listen to each other and are being willing to hear each other and trust each other's stories, I think that will really help to heal the soul of this nation. And remember, Jesus said the question, he was asked, who is my neighbor? And in the text of the Good Samaritan story, he makes it clear, your neighbor is the one who's different than you. How you treat your neighbor who's different from you is the question Jesus asked, and we have to answer.
Are there any, you talk about this to a variety of audiences really all over. Are there either small or large examples of people in places that are making a start and starting to change the dynamic in communities?
I'm glad you asked that, because for America's Original Sin, we've gone all over the country and had town meetings, very much like the one you're about to do. And all over the country, they've been large, multiracial, and especially intergenerational crowds, and interfaith, and people with no faith at all. And I walk away from those large gatherings with really good conversation having occurred, sometimes over 2 days, and then I go home and turn on the television. And it's so discouraging, the polarization, the tribalism. We have a political leader in the White House who's trying to tribalize us. And that's not hard to do because we are tribes. So I hear two stories. One is growing up around the country, there's a very hopeful conversation about a different American future that people want to be a part of, especially younger people. But then you turn on the TTV, and it's all about our tribalization, polarization. So those stories are in a battle right now. And I hope the story from the grassroots that's growing up can finally be the one that shapes a story about how we tried to heal the soul of our nation.
I think a lot of people would, I hope most people would agree with you. Reverend Jim Wallace, thank you so much for your conversation and for your work.
I've always loved Milwaukee, actually, and I'm looking forward to coming back.
Reverend Jim Wallace is founder and president of Sojourners. He's a panelist at Wednesday evening's community gathering on race and trauma, which is happening at the FISER Forum, the Bucks' new arena. You'll find a link to more information at WUWM.com.
We shift from the role of race in trauma to a question about race and education. Our race and ethnicity reporter answers a listener question on Beats Me when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. It's time for our latest installment of Beats Me. That's the series that gives you the chance to ask questions that our beat reporters then tackle.
Today, our race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell, takes a question about the number of African-American teachers in predominantly African-American Milwaukee public schools and whether that has an impact on students.
Listener Ann Stanton is curious about the impact of race on education.
What is the ratio of black students to white teachers and black teachers makeup in Milwaukee public schools, and what impact does that have on the student achievement?
She also explains that it was a podcast about education that spurred her curiosity.
I was listening to a podcast about the flip side of Brown versus Board of Education, and they had said that as a result of that decision and in public school integration, a lot of black teachers were ousted from their positions, and then the black students ended up with more white teachers who treated them differently or didn't have the same capabilities to relate to them culturally as their black teachers. So it impacted outcomes, and the disparities persist throughout the country.
I started looking into the topic by going to a couple MPS schools to see what some local classrooms look like and what both teachers and students had to say. My first visit was to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Elementary School, an African-American immersion school on Milwaukee's north side. Angela Harris is a kindergarten teacher there. I met her as she was leading her class in a morning routine. Harris, a black woman, says she has strong feelings about students seeing representation in their instructors.
I believe wholeheartedly that when you put people who look like you in front of you, it opens up a different outlook for yourself.
Harris says she pursued a career in education with that in mind. A Milwaukee native, Harris says teaching in a Milwaukee school, specifically in a kindergarten class, was always important to her as well.
Having the opportunity to stand in front of students who look just like me and say that this is potentially something that you could do with your life. You don't necessarily have to be a basketball player or a rapper. You can be a teacher. You can be a principal. You can be an administrator at a school. These are all actually goals that you can have for yourself. And there's so many people here who look just like you who have done this and who are successful at it.
Harris also commented on the connection she still has with students who have graduated from her class. Some of them, who are now second graders, eagerly rushed to hug her as she walked down the hall. Now, all of Harris's kindergarten students were black, but what about the demographics of teachers and students across Milwaukee public schools? I checked State Department of Instruction figures. The numbers show that during the 2017-2018 school year, 52% of students were black, but only 16% of the teachers were black. 70% of the teachers were white. Researchers have often examined the long and short-term effects of students of color having teachers that look like them. And one of them, Constance A. Lindsay, says, yes, it does matter. She describes results from one study conducted more than a decade ago.
Basically, like in 2004, 2005, there was a guy at Stanford, Tom D., who used an older data set from the Project STAR experiment, which was actually a class size experiment in Tennessee. And what's nice about experiments is that teachers are randomly assigned. And so he realized that in this random assignment, They were also randomly assigned by race.
Specifically, Dee's results found that students from disadvantaged groups score higher on standardized tests when randomly assigned to same-race teachers. Lindsay says studies that followed found similar results. She was one of a four-person team that explored the link between having a same-race teacher early in life and looking at later life outcomes. The team found,
if you have the experience of having one black teacher in elementary school, particularly for low-income black boys, you are less likely to drop out of high school and more likely to say that you're going to attend college.
The study found that having one black teacher in third through fifth grades decreased a black student's probability of dropping out of school by 29%. The impact was even greater for black boys in low-income families. Their probability of dropping out of school was reduced by 39% if they had a black teacher in third through fifth grades. But I also wanted to know what students thought about the importance of having black teachers. So I spoke with teens at Barack Obama's School of Career and Technical Education, also on the city's north side. Juniors Franchon Avant, Angel Angel, and senior Carlisha Dunn shared their thoughts.
I've had, like, a lot of white teachers that, you know, kind of did similar things. Like, you know, will motivate me, you know, tell me, like, do better. But this is, like, when it's coming from somebody that looks like you, somebody that you can just relate more, like somebody that has the same background knowledge as you, people that grew up in the same type of neighborhoods as you, it's just easier to relate to somebody like that.
I have to agree. It's, like, a better connection because, like, you can see where they're coming from. White people go through a struggle, too, just like black people. But, like, when you mixed or black, you really relate to people that look like you, talk like you, you know, present they stuff like you, something like that.
African American teachers could be like that because they see you and it'd be like, oh, when I was a kid, my support system wasn't that good. That's but I can be this, right? Yeah, yeah. I can be your support system and I can motivate you and be the reason why you come to school every day and smile.
The students did say, however, that a teacher's race shouldn't matter when it comes to connecting with every one of their students. And there are programs in Milwaukee to help teachers from all backgrounds incorporate culturally relevant curriculum to connect with their students. Meanwhile, some efforts are underway to put more teachers of color in the classroom. Education reporter Emily Files will explain what's happening behind the scenes in next Monday's Beats Me segment. Taryn Powell, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Support for Race and Ethnicity Reporting is provided by The Doman Company.
You can submit your own questions to our beat reporters at WUWM.com.
Tensions remain high between Russia and the UK in the wake of a case that involves double agents, poisoning, and collateral damage.
The case may have sounded like a relic of the Cold War, but Lake Effect essayist Art Sear says there is a contemporary context for it.
Prime Minister Theresa May and colleagues in Britain's government reconfirm the quality and effectiveness of her nation's police and intelligence work. On September 5, the British government issued warrants for the arrest of two Russian nationals, Rusyan Bosharov and Alexander Petrov, for attempted murder. Massive evidence has been assembled through high-tech means and old-fashioned human insight police work. The despicable effort in early March to murder Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia in England provides a grim reminder that the Cold War may be over, but Russia remains a dangerous and ruthless adversary. A police officer found the father and daughter unconscious on a park bench in Salisbury, a city near London. The Skripals and the police officer required hospitalization in intensive care. A Novichok nerve agent poisoned them. Novichok is the label for a highly lethal series of nerve agents developed by the Soviet Union beginning in 1971. Novichok is an extremely rare chemical not readily available to the public or even the criminal underworld. The military nerve agent remains a product of Russia. 4 months after the attack, residue of the poison left behind by the attackers struck down two more British citizens, in no way tied to government intelligence or security agencies, one of whom died. Bosharov and Petrov flew to Britain 2 days before the attempted murders. They entered the country on Russian passports. The British government worked quickly, identified them early, and continued to collect evidence. Skripal worked for the GRU, the military intelligence arm of Russia's government, until he retired in 1999. Later, he confessed to working as a double agent for British intelligence from 1995. In 2006, a Russian court convicted him and imposed a prison sentence of 13 years. In 2010, authorities freed him as part of a U.S.-Russia spy swap following the exposure of a ring of Russian espionage agents in the United States. During Skripal's trial, Russian media compared the damage done to state security to that of Oleg Penkovsky. That double agent provided important secret data to United States agents regarding Soviet military and intelligence resources. Information he provided is credited with helping President John F. Kennedy and associates maneuver successfully through the Cuban Missile Crisis of October 1962. The Soviet state executed Penkovsky in 1963. According to one report, executioners burned him alive in a crematorium, a warning to deter others. Also in 2006, Russian intelligence defector Alexander Litvinenko mysteriously suffered poisoning in London. On his deathbed, he blamed the Russian government. In response to the March attack on the Skripals, Vasily Nebenzia, Russia's permanent representative to the United Nations, presented a truly strange defense. In a long, rambling statement, he introduced the name of Sherlock Holmes, the legendary fictional British detective. Nebenzia publicly compared the British government to Inspector Lestrade, the inept police officer regularly bested by the vastly more able Holmes. The Russian diplomat on this occasion proved himself inept and unintentionally encouraged attention to another poisoning case. In November 2012, Russian Alexander Parapolichny suddenly collapsed and died while jogging near London. One post-mortem test found traces of gelsemium, a toxic plant. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, creator of Sherlock Holmes, was a medical doctor who experimented with a range of chemicals and plants, including gelsemium. Sir Arthur concluded the plant could alleviate nerve pain, but was also dangerous. Holmes' genius combines human insight and technical expertise. The British government has done the same in handling the brutal Skripal case.
Lake Effect contributor Art Sear is a professor of political economy and world business and director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha.
One more break, and then we'll learn why UW-Milwaukee is a particularly friendly campus for the LGBTQ plus community. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. For many college students, life on campus may be the first opportunity they have to live on their own. And once they're at school, their physical and mental comfort can spell the difference between a good and a bad college experience.
For students who identify as LGBTQ, those can be especially significant issues. Each year, the Campus Pride Index names the top 30 universities around the country that foster an inclusive environment for LGBTQ students. And for the fourth year in a row, UW-Milwaukee has been named one of them.
Authors of the study cite factors ranging from an inclusive housing policy to the school's LGBT studies program, gender-neutral bathroom facilities, and a chancellor's advisory committee for LGBTQ advocacy as contributing to a nearly perfect score on the index.
Jen Murray is director of the UWM LGBT Resource Center. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski and explained what it means to students and the university to have a welcoming and inclusive campus.
I think that we have seen and heard from students in the last 4 years of receiving this honor and distinction and designation for our campus, that it means a lot to see themselves be reflected and honored and affirmed in their campus environment. So they want to be part of the UWM LGBTQ plus family, and they also want to know that they can have Panther pride and be their full selves and see that they can be totally who they are. And so I think that students oftentimes are looking for opportunities to live, learn, and socialize within spaces that honor and respect the totality of who they are. And so having this recognition, given that we're rated as a five-star campus for LGBTQ plus friendliness, it is the highest rating that Campus Pride awards. And so I think that it demonstrates the commitment from administration, from faculty, staff, and the campus community to really make UWM stand out and be not only on the map, but also a treasure on the map for LGBTQ plus communities.
Now, on average, what is the percentage of the student body that identifies as LGBTQ+?
So it's a really difficult question to answer because we don't we don't actually take any demographic information in on applications for LGBTQ+ identities. So, and we also know that identity development happens oftentimes over the course of the lifespan. And so, because identities are fluid, it would be difficult to say that like a first year student coming in with an identity might hold that same identity. They may have a different identity by the time they're at their senior year. So there is a stellar researcher who. Is the name of Dr. Sue Rankin, and her associates have actually established that there's probably a conservative estimate would be 4% of any given population, and a very generous estimate would be 20% of any given population. And so I think that if you look at UWM student population being around 25,000, you know, I think that you could probably estimate from there whether or not we land in the 4 to 20%. And if you do the middle, probably around 10% of that population. And so I think that, you know, 2,500 students is a pretty good number to think about in terms of having LGBTQ+ identities.
Definitely. Now, this Campus Pride Index was in development since 2001, and it officially launched in 2007. But things at UWM have been in place much longer before you got your Campus Pride Index ratings. So when did UWM actively start to create a welcoming and safe, proactive environment for its LGBTQ community?
So UWM actually began in 1995 with a task force that convened only around lesbian, gay, bisexual, and actually bisexual wasn't an identity that was listed either. So it was really lesbian and gay communities. And there was a task force that was appointed by the chancellor at the time to really examine and look at what the climate was like for LG populations. And so I think that the progress that has been made since 1995 is that students made an investment and put a proposal together in the year 2000-2001 and put it before our student finance committee. And so the student association, the student segregated fees are what fund the LGBT Resource Center specifically. And the LGBT Resource Center has been in establishment since 2003, we opened up in that academic year. So we're at the tail end of our 15th anniversary year celebration. And I would say that, you know, over the course of the 15 years, we've definitely seen a greater awareness and a greater interest and knowledge from trans and non-binary communities. So that's something that I think has been celebrated. And I believe that Campus Pride has done a great job of working to try to find these measures that are self-reported to be able to allow for a campus to acknowledge where they've made great strides and improvements to work with and also intentionally include LGBTQ+ folks.
Absolutely. One important thing you mentioned is that the LGBT Resource Center is student-led and funded. So this kind of separates it from other, say, on-campus organizations or committees. Do you think this truly makes a difference in what attributes to this high score and consistently getting this rating and index because it's student-led and involved?
Yes. So I would say that the high score comes from student engagement and really reflecting the needs of our campus population. So students have a voice and have an opportunity to make a difference and create change, and they have done so over the course of the 15 years of the LGBT Resource Center's existence. I do need to also give some shout-outs to, you know, the Gay People Union, which was, you know, the student organizations and the mobilization that was happening early on, probably even prior to 1995. And so I think that there definitely is a nod to our history. And I'm always excited to say that we have an amazing number of LGBTQ+ campus partners, one of them being the Golda Meir Libraries, where there is the Special Collections and Archives that houses the premier history of Wisconsin LGBTQ+ communities, which is always super exciting. Also, we have the only standalone LGBT study certificate program at UW-Milwaukee. And so we have a number of measures, not to even forget another key piece is the Peck School of the Arts has the Milwaukee LGBT Film and Videos Festival. And so we have worked over the course of time with the LGBT Resource Center and getting students' needs. And then I think that it's looking at the campus community more broadly as well as the region. I think that, you know, Milwaukee is rich with a number of LGBTQ+ communities. And I use communities intentionally to talk about not just a singular monolithic entity, but really there are multiple people within our communities who hold multiple marginalized identities. And we want to make sure that we're respecting and honoring them as we work to uplift. In particular, our mission is around social justice-based education, looking at intersectionality and the intersectional experiences when we're doing the education, programming, and activities across the spectrums of gender and sexuality.
Right. It's much more than just hosting, you know, the annual drag shows or making sure that housing facilities are acceptable for all people. You know, you mentioned that it's a study certificate. So it's really part of the whole college experience, not necessarily the whole living on campus aspect for students.
Absolutely. And I think that it's the academic element as well as the social and the environmental components that are contributing to the success of LGBTQ plus students and preparing them to be in this global world that we're in.
So what resources are specifically offered at the LGBT Resource Center, and what other kind of initiatives and priorities does UWM take in order to make sure that its LGBTQ plus population is served properly?
So I would say that UW-Milwaukee was the first campus in Wisconsin to offer gender-inclusive housing, and that puts us ahead of our peers within the state, but also following a best practice across the nation in terms of creating inclusive living environments for LGBTQ plus folks. We also have offered students a chance to be known by their name and use, and that's an important piece so that students internally to our campus are recognized by the name that they use and honored by that name in the classroom and across campus when they're interacting and or interfacing with our systems and our campus resources. I would also say that UWM students are able to easily correct their gender identity within student records, and that's really a key piece. And then in terms of like programming, what LGBT Resource Center does is we host annual events like the Coming Out Monologues, which is an open mic event that's in celebration of National Coming Out Day. And then we also celebrate folks at our Lavender graduation celebration every year, and that is looking at their accomplishments and achievements. And so I like to think of, you know, we start out with a fall welcome the first year that somebody arrives, and every year we have that fall welcome reception, and every year we have a Coming Out Monologues. And we've sought to make sure that we have a Trans Empowerment Month, which will be in the month of November. And this year we're ecstatic because we're partnering with several people, Helen Bader School of Social Welfare, Peck School of the Arts, the Union Art Gallery, and we're bringing Translucent, which is a community exhibition and art installation that showcases our trans family. It is the Transilient Project and an artist from Portland, Oregon, as well as we're looking for submissions through October 5th for community and student artists to contribute to this Translucent art exhibition that will be coming in on November 16th with the opening night.
So with a campus that is actively involved in students' life, both in and outside the classroom, there was only a few things, very minor things, missing in your score index, such as students have the option to self-identify sexual orientation on admission application. You mentioned you don't take those numbers, but that they are able to change it while they're enrolled. LGBTQ social fraternity or sorority annually participates in LGBTQ admission fairs, and trans-inclusive student health insurance policy, which covers hormone replacement therapy. And I would imagine it's hard for any college to do that, much less a lot of other medical needs for all the student body. But are there any active plans to change any of these that weren't checked on this Campus Pride Index and strive towards a complete checklist in the future? Or what initiatives are you focusing on currently that you think will help make UWM a better place?
There are several of these areas that we are actually working on currently. One of them, we actually have an LGBTQ plus advocacy senator who is within our student association, and they work really closely with us. And also, and when I say us, I mean the LGBT Resource Center. Also, we have an active and engaged Chancellor's Advisory Committee for LGBT plus advocacy. And those two entities that are outside of the LGBT Resource Center work in tandem with us on several different initiatives, one of them being a double-sided ID. So we're working to be able to make sure that our name in use, or our preferred name system, as it is known on campus, is able to be where students can have both of their legal name as well as the name that they use recognized on their student IDs. And then we also have work around, and I think we've gotten a lot of recognition, I should say, about our pronoun card. So that's a card that we use that is an educational tool and a resource where people can be able to learn a little bit more about non-binary pronouns. And what I mean by that is a pronoun set that is not within the construct of he and she or masculine and feminine pronouns, but rather looking more broadly at the pronouns that are the singular use of the word they, and also vivivers, perpers, zizirzim. So there are multiple pronoun sets, and we have a sampling of them on our educational pronoun card. The third thing that I would talk about is we're working collaboratively with Norris Health Center and looking at what does it look like to offer the hormone replacement therapy and for them to start to initiate that. And they are, gratefully, we're happy to say that they are working with our students to do continuation of care for students who already have a prescription in place for their hormone therapy. And then I would also add that we have some amazing community partners. So we work with the Greater Milwaukee Health Center to help students make referrals that are for trans-inclusive health care beyond the UW-Milwaukee campus. I think that the other point that was made was around collecting of data, or the collection of data, and there was an addition of the gender category, an expansion of the gender category within the applications. And just as a point of clarification, I think when I talked about not collecting data, we do collect data around gender identity, but we aren't necessarily using that data and sort of reporting out because it's not necessarily something that we use other than providing resources and services for internally to our campus community. We do not collect data on sexual orientation or sexual identity, and that's something that we need to come out of a UW system initiative or a much broader, a larger scale initiative because it is a common application, and so it's a little bit larger of a project.
Well, yet I think
it's something.
Yeah, it's something
that I think that my peers and my colleagues across the system are invested and interested in, and I think that it's something that may come on board. And if it doesn't come on board, I think that we're still doing our best as a system to be able to make sure that we're honoring and reflecting through our non-discrimination policies and through our practices on our individual campuses.
Definitely. So 5 out of 5 with the Campus Pride Index. But also, I imagine you get a lot of good feedback from students and interactions you have every day. What advantage does UWM have in actively taking responsibility and engaging in continually improving their LGBTQ campus climate?
Oh, this is a key question. And I would say that we really are involved on multiple levels to work with the Chancellor's Cabinet, to work with the Provost Academic Leadership Council, to work with a number of our key campus partners to help them to really think through what does it look like to have policies and practices that affirm and advocate and support LGBTQ plus folks. And then we also have this external relationships that we've built with some of our community partners, looking at like diverse and resilient when we talk about the health and well-being of LGBTQ plus communities, or if we look at Cream City Foundation and the scholarships that they afford for some of our UWM students to be able, LGBTQ plus students to be present. So we have the Milwaukee LGBT Community Center. I mean, the list is pretty extensive to the number of community partners that we are connected to. And then we also have worked with a number of corporate entities. So BMO Harris Bank has been a huge supporter of our work in our educational outreach and initiatives. And we've had tremendous fortune in working with entities such as Baird, Harley-Davidson, Rockwell Automation. And so I feel really fortunate that we have kind of had this breadth and depth of engagement that allow for us to be a resource for not just our campus community, but also the wider Milwaukee area.
Jen Murray, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks again. I appreciate you having me. Take care.
Jen Murray is the director of the UWM LGBT Resource Center. She spoke with Audrey Nowakowski, and you can find out more information at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tighe. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock and Fresh Air is next.